It will be a high priority, and again, as a caucus, we'll be talking about it as a full caucus here in the next day or two.
Lawmakers react to a judge's ruling that Alaska's correspondence allotment system for students is unconstitutional. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 15th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, fewer Alaska children are tested for lead exposure than in other parts of the country, prompting increased testing access.
No lead in the blood is considered normal, but certain levels become concerning. That's why we're starting a lead clinic.
An Alaska Superior Court ruling has found a key benefit to families who choose certain types of homeschool violates the state constitution. The ruling has to do with correspondence school allotments. Those are cash payments to families of homeschooled children meant to reimburse the cost of things like textbooks, services, and even private school classes. Alaska Public Media state government reporter Eric Stone has been combing through the ruling and joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Casey.
All right, so what does this ruling actually say?
Okay, so the ruling recaps the case so far and the laws at issue. So in January 2023, four parents of school-aged children sued. They're challenging the constitutionality of a 2014 law that, quote, authorizes school districts with correspondence programs to provide an annual student allotment to a parent or guardian of a student enrolled in the correspondence study program for the purpose of meeting instructional expenses for the student. So the law allows families to purchase, quote, non-sectarian services and materials from public sources like school districts, as well as private or religious organizations. The purchases have to be approved by the school district and abide by state standards, including by coming up with an individual learning plan. The allotments can be up to $4,500 per student per school year. Judge Adolf Zeman found that system unconstitutional. He found that it violates Article 7 of the Alaska Constitution. That says, in part, quote, no money shall be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or private educational institution, end quote. So basically, the allotments are paid to parents, some of whom spend them on private school courses, and that's unconstitutional, according to the ruling. And the judge didn't just invalidate spending on private or religious schools. He found there was no way to narrow the law enough to be constitutional and tossed out the whole correspondence school allotment system. So spending on textbooks, public school courses, activities, all of that is now invalidated. And the judge basically wrote, if the legislature thinks these expenditures are necessary, then it's up to them to write a law to make that happen.
Okay, so how did this system come about?
So basically, the allotment system is an effort to give students and families more choices over their education. In the ruling, Zeman reaches back to the legislative debate that began just over 11 years ago in 2013. Mike Dunleavy, the governor now, then a senator, he sponsored the bill and he pitched it to lawmakers alongside a constitutional amendment, appearing to acknowledge that the Alaska Constitution doesn't allow public money to be spent on private school classes. Let's take a listen to that.
A parent could decide, I want my child to take a Latin course at Monroe Catholic. The teacher could agree to that in the ILP. Currently, we cannot do that under the state of under the current constitutional language.
So that's Dunleavy in his initial presentation of Senate Bill 100, and that was later incorporated into House Bill 278, a big omnibus bill that passed out in 2014. Of course, correspondence learning and homeschool have a very long history in Alaska. Prior to 2014, Lon Garrison of the Association of Alaska School Boards told me that correspondence students would learn from curriculum that was provided by their local district or a statewide homeschool program, but that changed with the allotment program. Let's take a listen.
And it gave that opportunity for parents to really kind of determine what they wanted in terms of curricular material and instructional materials.
But that changed over time, said Scott Kendall. He's an attorney representing the plaintiffs. Around 2020, 2021, he said, private schools began promoting the idea of dual enrollment, basically using the allotments for private school tuition.
In fact, you would enroll in a private school and they would enroll you in the correspondence program and you would basically just submit your tuition bills as though those were, in fact, expenses related to correspondence school or homeschooling, and then you'd get paid back.
Jody Taylor, the wife of Alaska Attorney General Treg Taylor, wrote an op-ed in the Anchorage Daily News detailing exactly how parents can use the correspondence school program to pay for private school tuition, and she used a private Catholic elementary school as an example. Proponents, including Jody Taylor in her op-ed, say the system gives families the choice to pursue the education they want for their children. Attorney Kirby West of the Institute for Justice, which argued in favor of the allotment program, says parents use their allotments for all manner of things.
Online courses through public universities is a really common one. To either, supplement homeschooling curriculum or to just, standalone, in enrollment in college courses from public universities. Many parents do use the allotment for tuition at private schools.
And her clients actually use it for tuition at a Catholic school, she said.
Well, what are people saying about the ruling now?
So unsurprisingly, the plaintiffs say the judge's ruling is sound. The judge actually went further than Kendall asked. Basically, he asked them to invalidate spending on private or religious schools, and the judge said there's no way to make the rest of the law constitutional. So that's, he tossed out the whole program. Meanwhile, Attorney General Treg Taylor says the ruling is flawed. Let's hear from Treg Taylor.
I don't agree with the logic that he applied to the ruling. So he made two statutes completely unconstitutional, which I think was unnecessary. And so I think his decision went overboard in what I think was within the law.
He says the issue has his and Governor Mike Dunleavy's full attention, and they're seeking a stay and an appeal. He declined to say whether public money should be spent on private or religious schools. Kirby West, the Institute for Justice attorney, says they also plan to appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court. She says the state payments aren't a, quote, direct benefit in the constitutional language. They're payments that parents can spend on all manner of things.
So if the state, for example, created a program that was giving a monthly allowance to people to purchase food, no one would think, right, that is a direct benefit for Walmart or Fred Meyer or another grocery store, because the state doesn't know how people are going to spend their money. They don't know what they're going to buy or where they're going to buy it.
And she says basically the people getting the direct benefit are the parents, not private or religious schools.
How are lawmakers reacting?
So leaders in the state House and Senate say they're considering their next steps. Kendall says the solution could be simple because the constitutional issue has to do with private and religious schools. He says lawmakers could simply pass a bill that says allotments can't be used at those kinds of schools. It's early at this point, but it does have policymakers' attention. Here's House Speaker Kathy Tilton.
It will be a high priority, and again, as a caucus, we'll be talking about it as a full caucus here in the next day or two to find our path forward.
But it's a little too early at this point to say what lawmakers will do about it.
Eric, what does this mean for parents and students, and what lies ahead?
So those are both really hard questions to answer at this point. I'll say, though, that the changes, I'm not expecting them to take effect this school year. The administration says there are about 24,000 students who could be affected by the ruling. Kendall says the plaintiffs plan to seek a stay. That means putting the ruling on hold until the end of the fiscal year in June. The idea there is to not disrupt the school year. If the plaintiffs and the defense are both asking for a stay, I think it's fairly likely it'll be granted. The appeal, though, to the Alaska Supreme Court and perhaps beyond to the U.S. Supreme Court could take months or years.
Well, that was Alaska Public Media state government reporter Eric Stone. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Alaska Congresswoman Mary Peltola is far ahead of her Republican challengers in campaign fundraising. She raked in $1.7 million in the first 3 months of the year. About 90% of that is from individuals, but like most incumbents in Congress, she also received dozens of contributions from political action committees. Many of the committees are affiliated with unions and trade associations. PACs related to oil and coal companies also gave to Peltola, a Democrat who has acted to support domestic oil and gas development. The Republican contenders raised just a fraction of Peltola's haul during the first quarter of the year. Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom's total came to $260,000. Nick Begich is only about $40,000 behind Dahlstrom. But Dahlstrom's campaign finance report shows signs of continued fundraising might. Several political action committees linked to House Republican leaders gave to Dahlstrom. One, the Congressional Leadership Fund, is also making independent expenditures to support her candidacy. So far, the fund has spent $75,000 on pro-Dahlstrom ads, and it can spend more. Federal law puts no limit on independent expenditures. Peltola is also benefiting from independent expenditures. A group called Center Forward Committee has bought ads worth $300,000 to support her. The organization promotes moderate candidates. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska tribes prepare to offer indigenous tourism.
Alaska has the largest number of federally recognized tribes than any other state. There is so much potential there.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Peter Pan Seafood announced Friday it's ceasing operations. The state-backed seafood processor has faced mounting troubles, including legal claims from fishermen claiming back-owed payments for unpaid deliveries of fish. The company made the announcement Friday night on Facebook, saying it was, quote, saddened to share that Peter Pan Seafoods will be halting operations at its processing plants. That includes the discontinuation of both summer and winter production. Another seafood giant, Silver Bay Seafoods, announced it would acquire Peter Pan's Valdez facility, as well as operate Peter Pan's facilities in Dillingham and Port Moeller during the 2024 salmon season. That announcement left out King Cove, the eastern Aleutian community where Peter Pan's largest processing facility is located. Commenters on Facebook expressed frustration and disappointment that the company waited until less than 2 months before the start of salmon season to announce its summer plans. King Cove, a community of around 800 residents, relies on the processing facility as its main economic engine. The city already faced hardship when Peter Pan opted last minute not to open for winter's A season, forcing local fishing boats to scramble for new facilities where they could deliver their catch. Peter Pan said current or former employees can seek processing jobs at Silver Bay Seafoods, but did not specify which facilities would be hiring. High exposure to lead can be harmful to people, especially babies and children, whose brains and bodies are still developing. In Alaska, fewer children get tested than in other parts of the country, so public health officials with the state and the city of Anchorage are launching new programs to encourage testing and learn more about lead poisoning in the state. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
Kaylee is playing with her four-month-old daughter, who is nicknamed Bun or Bunnick, the Inupiaq word for daughter. We're not using Kaylee's last name to protect her family's privacy. Bunnick is just starting to learn how to roll over from her tummy to her back. Her doctor says she's right on track developmentally, but that's not something Kaylee takes for granted. When she first got pregnant, she had been working at a metals mine in Alaska for 2 years.
That's what made me realize I should check my lead levels and be more careful about that.
When her job tested her, Kaylee's blood levels of lead were over 6 micrograms per deciliter. That's almost twice what's considered high by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She says her midwife consulted with a health expert in Seattle because she didn't have enough experience with prenatal lead exposure.
Yeah, when I first realized that the lead levels could be concerning, I was pretty scared. I was really scared when the midwife was worried about the lead levels and she was talking to somebody in Seattle.
State epidemiologists say Alaskans can be exposed to lead through many jobs and hobbies, including mining, fishing, and hunting. And while they recommend that all children are screened for lead exposure, only about 10% of kids in Alaska are tested. That's much lower than the national average. So the state is relaunching a working group to coordinate public health efforts around lead exposure. And the Anchorage Health Department is starting a lead testing clinic so families can get connected with help if kids test high. Dr. Michael Savitt is a pediatrician and chief medical officer for the city. He says if lead is in the house, it's easy for young kids to be exposed because they put everything in their mouths.
No lead in the blood is considered normal, but certain levels become concerning. So that's why we're starting a lead clinic so that we can get a handle on the situation.
Kids can be exposed through many things, including old paint, soil, game meat with lead shot, or hunting supplies. Savitt says if families think their child may have been exposed, they should get tested, either at the new clinic or through their healthcare provider.
If mom is the one who has the lead contamination, then it may be passed to the baby in breast milk. But if there's any concern, any consideration that there may have been an exposure, I would urge people to have their blood tested. It's a very simple test.
Savitt says the clinic will test people for lead on site, so the results will be available within about 15 minutes. And he says the clinic can connect anyone with high lead levels to care. Sometimes lead poisoning is asymptomatic, but Savitt says high lead levels can lower kids' IQ and cause behavior and hearing problems.
A child can be irritable, fretful, can complain of headache, abdominal pain. There may be a poor appetite, which would impact growth. It can affect the central nervous system.
Many of the effects of lead poisoning on kids are permanent, but the right care can help reduce lead levels to prevent more harm. Statewide last year, about 4% of Alaskan kids who were tested had high lead levels. Allison Natcher is the state's Environmental Public Health Program Manager. She says it's important for families to consider ways they could be bringing lead and other contaminants into the house. And she says the state is restarting a multidisciplinary working group to help reduce Alaskans' lead levels. It includes public health nurses, doctors, epidemiologists, and tribal entities.
It's everybody kind of coming together saying, we recognize that we need to make improvements and we want kiddos to be safe and healthy. And that also extends to their parents too. We want everyone to be safe and healthy.
If kids get tested and have high lead levels, the Environmental Health Department can work with them to figure out how they're getting exposed. Nadra says good nutrition can help prevent high lead levels by reducing lead absorption.
We recommend consumption of foods rich in iron, calcium, zinc, selenium, fiber, and vitamins B, C, and E, in addition to reducing your sugar intake.
Kaylee, the mother who was working in a mine, couldn't negotiate a position with less lead exposure, so she quit her job a couple of months after testing high. Since then, her lead levels have come down, and last time she was tested, she was within the normal range. Her daughter, Bunnick, is on track developmentally, and Kaylee plans to test Bunnick's lead levels in the future. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Representative Mary Peltola gave video presentations last week at Kodiak's commercial fisheries trade show, ComFish. The seafood industry is facing historic challenges, and as KMXT's Brian Venwa reports, the pair hope closing a loophole on Russian imports could help bolster Alaska's presence in markets.
Murkowski and Peltola addressed the current state of Alaska's commercial fishing industry in a pre-recorded video on the opening day of ComFish. Both noted the historic slump has led several seafood processing companies like Peter Pan and Trident to sell off plants. The common claim from the companies has been a tumultuous global market. Representative Mary Peltola told attendees she blames the industry's struggles on Russia undercutting the U.S.
Alaskan fishermen are at an unfair disadvantage competing against the unsustainable fishing and forced labor of foreign imports.
Russian seafood products were banned from the U.S. years ago. However, there was a loophole in the legislation. Russian caught fish being processed in other countries like China were still allowed to be imported and sold in American markets. That loophole was open until President Joe Biden signed an executive order closing it late last year. The new ban will take effect next month. Senator Lisa Murkowski shared a similar sentiment in her video as well.
When I spoke to you all a year ago, there was really no telling what 2023 had in store for us. We did not know the extent to which Russia's predatory pricing would upset the global market. We did not know that base prices for salmon would plummet.
To help stimulate the industry, Murkowski says she's working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to continue purchasing Alaska seafood. The USDA bought about $200 million worth of Alaska seafood last year and has already announced plans to buy nearly another $150 million worth this year. Murkowski also brought up a continued push from the Alaska's congressional delegation to include fisheries in the upcoming federal farm bill reauthorization. Senator Dan Sullivan is scheduled for an in-person presentation at ComFish on Saturday. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
Diamond High School grad Alyssa Peely was drafted 8th overall in today's Women's National Basketball Association draft by the Minnesota Lynx. Peely is the 6th Alaskan to make the WNBA. She now shares the record as the highest overall WNBA draft pick by an Alaskan with her new teammate Ruthie Hebert of Fairbanks. Here she is in November before playing in the Great Alaska Shootout at the Alaska Airlines Center in Anchorage.
That's always been a childhood dream of mine, to be drafted.
Peely graduated from Diamond in 2019 and initially played for the University of Southern California, earning Pac-12 Freshman of the Year honors and being named to the All-Pac-12 team. Peely then transferred to the University of Utah in 2022, where she starred as the team's leading scorer and rebounder for the last 2 years. Pili is Inupiaq and Samoan and has developed a following of indigenous basketball fans eager to see her wherever she plays. Utah head coach Lynn Roberts remarked on Pili's homecoming before the University of Utah won the 2023 Great Alaska Shootout last November.
I think what's pretty neat is the pride that Alyssa has in being from Alaska. There is a ton of pride in being Alaskan and her heritage and her family.
Pili's season with the Lynx will begin in under a month when the Lynx tip off against the Seattle Storm on May 14th. Well, Alaska Democrats unanimously chose President Joe Biden in party elections over the weekend as their candidate for president, KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Democratic Party members from all around the state got together in person and online Saturday to nominate the incumbent president for re-election.
President Biden won all 17 of Alaska's state delegates to the national convention, meaning he won the state of Alaska.
State Democratic Party Chair Michael Wenstrup concedes that's probably no surprise to anyone because his only challenger, Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips, dropped out of the race last month and endorsed the president. But also because the unanimous voice vote shows Biden has strong support among Alaska Democrats.
There was no protest votes that I've been made aware of. Everyone that participated enthusiastically supported President Biden.
A news release issued after Saturday's presidential preference primary says party leaders went ahead and conducted the vote despite the lack of a challenger because they, quote, remained committed to a democratic process to determine presidential preference, unquote. But Wenstrup says the leadership decided to downsize the non-competitive proceeding.
Rather than to run a more expensive primary that could cost us upwards of $400,000 or more, we decided, since there was only one nominee on our ballot, to simply have each district caucus meet and cast their vote in their districts.
He says party members in all 40 state districts got together to weigh in on the nominee, including regional get-togethers in Anchorage and the MATSU.
Only Juneau and Fairbanks met in person. The rest of the districts met on their own, via Zoom or in person, depending on the logistics and the size of their districts or region.
Also Saturday, Democrats elected delegates to the party's state convention to be held next month in Juneau. The delegates will review the party's platform and bylaws and will, in turn, elect delegates to the national convention to be held in August in Chicago. Biden and former President Donald Trump are the presumed candidates of their respective parties for the November 5th general election. Alaska Republicans selected Trump as their nominee over rival candidate Nikki Haley during their party's March 5th presidential preference poll. Alaska voters also will cast ballots for local and state office and possibly a ballot measure during this busy election year. The partisan primary is scheduled for August 20th, and the winners of those races will then seek election during the November 5th general. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Research shows cultural tourism is on the rise in Indian country because travelers crave authenticity and want deeper experiences with indigenous peoples. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, Alaska tribes could be poised to take advantage of this trend.
Cultural tourism in Alaska can be as simple as a hike on a trail with a native storyteller, or a workshop on native art, or a visit to a dance festival. Although it's still in its infancy, Emily Edenshaw says cultural tourism holds a lot of promise for the whole state.
It's a sleeping giant. It's untapped.
Edenshaw is director of the Alaska Native Heritage Center, one of five Native groups across the nation to receive federal money to expand cultural tourism. She says it's an opportunity to rethink tourism in Alaska, which has come to rely too much on wildlife and scenery to draw tourists.
Come and see the mountains and the brown bears and come explore and discover and go on the glaciers and look at the bears. What about the indigenous experience? Our people have been here for 10,000 years, in some cases even longer than that.
The Heritage Center will receive about $50,000 to boost tourism. The money comes from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which has partnered with the American Indian Alaska Native Travel Association to oversee the grants. The association's director, Sherry Rupert, says it's a good time to invest in indigenous tourism.
Visitation to our communities is increasing. That's why we're so interested in supporting efforts up in Alaska, because Alaska has the largest number of federally recognized tribes than any other state. there is so much potential there for these small communities.
Rupert says cultural tourism not only creates jobs and economic opportunity, but also helps tribes hold on to their heritage.
I think it really sparks a light and really sparks that pride in who they are. So it helps us to preserve our cultural identity.
Edenshaw says the grant will be leveraged with other public and private funds and will complement ongoing efforts at the Heritage Center to study the impacts of cultural tourism.
We need to get the data. We need to know how many jobs it creates. We need to know the economic impact through a cultural tourism lens. And the truth is this has never happened in Alaska.
As the Alaska Native Heritage Center approaches its 25th anniversary, Edenshaw says tourism is not just about the history of Alaska Natives, but also their future. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, Rachel Cassandra and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Brian Venwa in Kodiak, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.